WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The end of the Cold War has led our president to propose a new world order. Economics writer Robert Kuttner says the end of the Cold War should bring about a new economic order at home. It's time to stop being the global cop, time to scale down the arms race to very expensive enterprises, and time to redirect our energy to restoring our own economic health. Kuttner is the economics correspondent for The New Republic and a columnist for the Boston Globe and Business Week. Last week, he spoke with us about the effect of the Gulf War on our economy. We've invited him back to discuss America's post-Cold War economy, the subject of his new book, The End of Laissez-Faire. A free market laissez-faire system won't give us what we need the most, Kuttner says. It's going to take some government planning to rebuild the infrastructure, care for the needy, improve education and public health, and make America more competitive in the global market. Other countries recognize this, he says. They have ministries of planning. The closest we come is the Pentagon, where government and industry work together.
The Pentagon becomes the one agency that is able to spend public money developing new technologies, planning for the future with really long-term horizons of the sort that are required if you're building very complicated weapon systems. So the result is that our Ministry of Planning is totally militarized. And that's why you have this anomalous situation where we can manufacture and design and mass-produce cruise missiles that are capable of crawling down the air shaft of a target at a distance of 500 miles, but we can't make VCRs, or we can't compete with the Japanese in microelectronics generally. And the reason for this is twofold. First of all, military technology is becoming more and more rarefied, more and more isolated. It's not like the early Cold War era where the Air Force could subsidize the development of a jet transport, and that jet transport could be converted to a Boeing 707 and give the American economy commercial supremacy in civil aviation. Today, you've got technologies like the stealth technology. You've got very rarefied military technologies that either don't have commercial spillovers, or if they do have potential commercial spillovers, the technology is considered too sensitive to let out of military control. For example, the United States, through companies like Cray Research, makes computers, supercomputers, that can outperform anything the Japanese make. But because the primary purpose of these computers has been historically to design nuclear weapons for the Pentagon and for the Department of Energy, the military establishment is very leery about letting this technology out of the country, which puts Cray at a commercial disadvantage when it tries to compete head-to-head with Hitachi or NEC or one of the other Japanese producers.
They have no such kinds of regulations in Japan?
They do, but they administer them more lightly, so that when one of our producers goes head-to-head with a Japanese producer in a third country, the salesman for the Japanese producer can wink at the customer and say, look, if you buy Japanese, you're going to end up with a lot less red tape. We put all kinds of controls on the sale of high-tech items that encumber them and put American exporters at a disadvantage. Now, there was a time when the United States was so powerful commercially, was so far ahead economically, that we could play this way and it didn't really matter. But I think that era ended in the 1980s. And yet, because we continue to view national security only in military terms and not in economic terms, while all other major countries view their security primarily in economic terms, we have prolonged this illusion that we are the last remaining superpower, that laissez-faire, the invisible hand of Adam Smith, will take care of the economy. And unfortunately, even though in 1989 we finally got a respite from this role, with the Berlin Wall coming down and the Cold War ending, we finally got an opportunity to share the burden with our allies for keeping the peace. We are now into yet another era of Pax Americana II, where the enemy has changed. The enemy is now Arab nationalism, but we are sort of congratulating ourselves that we are the only superpower, that the Europeans and the Japanese are sort of wimps. They're not putting up much in the way of troops. They are grudgingly spending some money. And we rather like this role. It's a set of habits that was learned during the Cold War, and unfortunately, it's a set of habits that is carrying over into the post-Cold War era. And that's why, in large part, the Japanese, the Germans, the Koreans, the French are eating our lunch.
No, you're also suggesting that it's really too expensive. It's just too costly for the United States to try to maintain itself as like the dominant world power, and that that kind of military dominance is sacrificing our economic health.
Well, this is a very important point. I mean, I'm certainly not the first person to argue that the cost of the Cold War has become excessive, and the cost of dominion in other theaters has become excessive. Professor Paul Kennedy, a couple of years ago, wrote a whole book on the concept of military overstretch. I'm suggesting something else. It's not simply the cost. It's the whole set of priorities that go with the role. It's the way you run your economy. It's the fact that the United States offers a very open market as one of the perquisites that goes along with alliance with the United States. And it denies itself the kind of hard bargaining over access to other people's markets that other countries routinely engage in. Anybody who argues that the Japanese are not playing by the same rules that we're playing by is dismissed as a Japan basher, which is preposterous. Some of the people who are most knowledgeable and most admiring of Japan, like Clyde Prestowitz, who was formerly the chief Japan expert in the Reagan administration, argue that precisely because Japan is so good at what it does economically, it's all the more important for Japan to play fair and to admit American companies into the loop and not to treat Japan Incorporated as a closed club. But if the United States views its role as having a special responsibility for the security of the whole system, the United States tends to be rather indulgent of the sins committed by its military allies in the economic realm.
What do you mean?
Well, when Germany sells technology to third world countries that we don't approve of, or when Japan commits the heresy of economic planning that we don't engage in ourselves, we sort of shrug and we say, well, they vote with us in the United Nations. They're our most loyal Cold War allies. So it really doesn't matter if they're eating our lunch economically, because that's the free market speaking. And I think that suggests that our priorities are backwards. We ought to be demanding more of a sharing of the burden in the keeping of the peace, and we ought to be demanding more fair play economically.
Do you think that military security and economic security are necessarily in conflict?
No. I think the role that the United States has taken on for itself as chief keeper of the peace and chief propagator of laissez-faire has put those two goals in conflict.
Economist Robert Kuttner is my guest. He's written a new book called The End of Laissez-faire. I think most people think of laissez-faire as a kind of lack of ideology. You know, it's just free market. There's no ideology that dominates. But you see laissez-faire as being an ideology and one that's really hurt the United States.
I'm very glad you said that. Sure. Laissez-faire is as much of an ideology as Marxism is an ideology. Laissez-faire holds that the economy operates most efficiently when the government stays out of the economy's way. We have never had a pure laissez-faire system, but under the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, laissez-faire has been the ideal. The operating principle has been the more you can deregulate, the better it is for the economy. The more you can privatize, the better it is for the economy. The more you can reduce government spending, the better it is for the economy. The difficulty with that is, first of all, that history shows that simply isn't true, and the Great Depression, I think, is the proof of that, that whenever you leave markets to their own devices, you get terrible instability as well as terrible inequity. The other problem is that none of our major trading partners believe in laissez-faire. They believe that the government has a role to play as a partner of industry in economic development. And if we are the only kid on the block playing by laissez-faire rules, other countries are going to eat our lunch.
Give us an example of another country that really sees the government as a partner in industry, and you think that that's really helping them economically and industrially.
Well, of course, Japan is the premier example of that. And it's not that Japan has a central ministry of Gosplan the way Russia does. But the Japanese government works intimately with Japanese industry in a great variety of ways. Japan is much more cartelized than we are. It's much clubbier than the United States. It has a small number of large corporate and banking combines called keiretsu, which give Japanese industry a tremendous amount of market power, give Japanese industry a lot of cheap capital, and allow Japanese industry to plan for the long term. And the government really doesn't issue commands, but the government helps coordinate it, the government helps subsidize it, and there is a consciousness on the part of Japanese industry of doing what is good for the Japanese nation that simply doesn't exist in the United States. If Ford finds it more convenient to produce in Europe, Ford produces in Europe. If an American high-tech manufacturer finds it more convenient to make some of its products in Mexico or in Malaysia, it does it. So there's a kind of nationalism, an economic nationalism that Japan, Korea, most of the other new Asian powers have, and that Europe, to a somewhat lesser extent, also has. Europe, for example, has insisted that in its bargaining with Japan, that as a quid pro quo, as a condition for Japan selling in Europe, Japan do a certain amount of manufacture in Europe. We shrink back in horror at that kind of diplomacy as the worst sort of economic nationalism. But it is the way the rest of the world plays, and Germany and France and Japan managed to get along rather well, even though none of them practice the kind of laissez-faire that American economists think they ought to practice.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Kuttner, who writes about economics. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe and Business Week, economics correspondent for the New Republic, and author of a new book called The End of Laissez-Faire, National Purpose and the Global Economy After the Cold War. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Economics writer Robert Kuttner is my guest, author of the new book, The End of Laissez-Faire. Listen, let's promote you to the position of czar, not even president. If you were president, you'd have to get things through the Congress. But let's promote you to czar so you could just, like, totally rewrite economic policy. And let's see what you would come up with if you had that kind of power. Give us a sense of what a planned economy a la Robert Kuttner would look like in the United States.
Well, it certainly wouldn't look like a planned economy in the Soviet Union. I mean, it would have to be something that fit our history, our culture, our economic institutions. There's a pretty good precedent for the kind of economy that I would like to see us have, and that is the kind of wartime planning we did during World War II. And I say that in two respects. We are at a real impasse now in terms of how we get out of this recession, because we are dependent on foreign borrowing, which reduces our ability to lower interest rates. We have a huge deficit, which reduces our ability to get out of the recession with deficit spending. And our banking system is shaky. I think that leaves a recovery strategy based on public investment as the best way to get us out of this recession. A recovery strategy based on public investment would also have the virtue of playing catch-up and making up for our failure to keep pace with necessary public infrastructure investment during the 1980s.
What kind of industrial policy objectives would you suggest?
Well, I think I would proceed on two fronts. First of all, I would enact a surtax on wealthy Americans to pay for most of this, because the rate of tax paid by the top 10% of the income distribution has been cut, while the effective tax paid by most people, when you count payroll taxes, has increased. Secondly, I would change our official ideology to allow American policy to have goals with respect to the development of certain key technologies. I think it's very important in the 21st century for the United States to remain competitive in basic broad technologies like microelectronics that are keys to industrial competitiveness across the board. And third, I would spend a lot of money rebuilding the infrastructure in a way consistent with good environmental and energy policy, which has been completely left to the vagaries of the invisible hand during the 1980s. So I would use infrastructure policy, technology policy, and I would pay for it with a surtax on wealthy people to put Americans back to work and, in the process, help America become more competitive again.
What kind of government policy, though, would spur on new innovations in American technology and make us more competitive globally?
Let me give you a very concrete example. There's a technology called magnetic levitation rail technology, maglev for short. Sounds very futuristic, but in fact there is already a train line in Germany. It looks a little bit like the monorail in Disney World, but mm-hmm. it goes at speeds of up to 300 miles an hour, and it is exceptionally efficient for medium-run transit, 100-mile, 200-mile, 300-mile runs. Now, this technology, and this gets back to something I said earlier, this technology was invented at Brookhaven National Laboratory by Westinghouse under contract to the U.S. government, but the military decided it had no military use. So the technology was sold to the Germans. Right now in Pittsburgh, there's a consortium of companies and individuals called Maglev Incorporated that wants to develop this technology as a way of doing several things simultaneously. It would reestablish Pittsburgh as an industrial center. It would put America at the forefront of this new technology. It would provide a way of rebuilding rail transit in the United States, and it would create an export industry for the world. Problem is, this requires federal funding. No private entrepreneur is going to come forward with the kind of money necessary to build a rail line from Cleveland to Pittsburgh. It also requires government planning in the sense that government would have to decide that short-run maglev rail is something we want. If you contrast this with what France did when France rebuilt its subways 20 years ago, the French, who have been committing economic planning ever since King Louis, decided that if they were going to spend a lot of money to rebuild the Paris metro, they might as well develop an export industry at the same time. So the French government sunk a lot of money into subway technology, into learning how to build state-of-the-art subways, and at the same time created a state-owned company called Sofretou, which is now one of the world's leading exporters of entire mass transit systems. If you propose that in George Bush's America, you would be dismissed as the worst kind of economic planner. But this, in fact, is what most other industrial countries are perfectly willing to do, and it's what the United States is not willing to do because we believe in the gospel laid down by Adam Smith and picked up by Ronald Reagan.
Let me ask you, when you see Japanese companies purchasing American entertainment conglomerates and media companies and so on, are you disturbed by that?
I'm not disturbed by it per se, but I'm disturbed by the asymmetry of it. After World War II, American companies purchased a large number of European companies, but we did not keep European companies out of the United States. So if you look at the Japanese situation, you have Japan having completely free access to the United States, buying up whatever it wants to buy. But on the flip side, you have, you're probably familiar with the story of T. Boone Pickens, who was trying to buy an auto parts company in Japan, and he's just not a member of the club. And even though he owns something like 30% of the stock, he's just trying to buy it up on the old, on the open market, the old-fashioned way, he is being denied the rights that normally accrue to a shareholder. Similarly, Japan Incorporated limits the way American industry is able to penetrate. If an American company wants to go into Japan, often the quid pro quo extracted by the Japanese is that the American company has to license technology that is proprietary, that is the basis for its competitive advantage. It has to license that technology to its Japanese competitors. The Japanese have a whole different set of rules as far as patent protection is concerned. So I'm not afraid of Japan coming into the United States because I don't like Japanese people. I think it's great if Japan wants to come into the United States. But I think if they're going to play that way, they have to let our people into Japan according to the same set of rules, and that's not currently the case.
We only have about a minute left, but I'm wondering, do you find that your views of the economy are very different from your colleagues, your most like-minded colleagues?
I find that a great number of economists who were brought up on Adam Smith dismiss this view. I find that most political conservatives dismiss this view, although, interestingly, a lot of American industrialists who are getting killed because other countries don't play by the same rules are finding this set of views attractive. So that it's difficult to pigeonhole this view of the world in terms of whether it's left or right. There are people who consider themselves conservative Republicans and people who consider themselves liberal Democrats who pretty much share my views.
And you think we'll be moving in this direction in the near future?
I think it depends on how bad things get. Revolutions in thinking rarely occur when times are good. I don't want to be in the position of hoping that times are going to be bad so that the country is more receptive to these views. But I think the economy is enough of a mess already that I think pretty soon there is going to be a receptivity to a new way of thinking.
Robert Kuttner, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your thinking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Robert Kuttner is the author of the new book, The End of Laissez-Faire, National Purpose and the Global Economy After the Cold War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.